It's good, and we're doing this, and it's good to see you again. So, Vinay, good to see you. Sanjali, great to see you. And today we're talking about root causes of diseases. And we are talking about one potential root cause in particular, and that is the roundtable we just had on talc. Mm-hmm. And so we convened experts from around the world, and they came and educated us about talc, and it was pretty eye-opening, I would say.
It was. I have, you know, my association of talc was always baby powder, right?
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, when a certain company was in the news a couple of years ago, but I had not thought about it since then, and now I'm reevaluating a lot of what I consume now.
Yeah, I learned a ton, and I had not appreciated that it was used almost as an industrial lubricant in the tablets and pills of even commonly taken prescription medications. I hadn't appreciated that that was the case.
The number 1, 3, 9, and 10 most common medications in the United States have talc.
In the pill.
In the pill or on the pill.
Presumably so that it doesn't get stuck when it goes through the machines that machine it or something.
The machine or to keep the texture of the pill.
I see.
And so 20 million Americans plus are taking talc probably on a daily basis on top of the talc that appears in food.
Yeah. Tell us about that. It appears in like gum or something.
Yeah, so I mean, it's crazy. So, you know, I grew up, my grandfather would always like have gum in his pocket and have pockets in his jacket.
My dad would always have
and
a certain.
So gum. I didn't know this. I always thought if you like open gum.
Do you chew gum, by the way? Is that something you do?
I do, okay. But now
it's
I need to reevaluate this.
I mean, it's
this.
Not smoking cigarettes. I mean,
it's like as a kid, right? It was like this treat. And so, I don't know if you can see it, but like this, like
yeah,
there's this white, like dusting. And I always thought it was sugar.
I thought it was flavor, yeah.
I thought it was sugar
I
or flavor.
I assumed it was flavor.
But I think in most cases, it's talc.
So it doesn't stick to the wrapper.
Yeah, to make it.
Talc is definitely, I don't know how frequent, but it definitely is used to prevent sticking when it comes to gum and candy. And it's been used ubiquitously throughout the food supply. So lollipops with the wrappers, they might have talc on. Whenever you see that white powder, sometimes that is talc.
Well, I'm trying to look at the numbers, and I was trying to quantify it, but it's really hard because usually it presents in trace amounts. So sometimes you don't see it on ingredient lists, I think some places, in the medications, generic versions may be less likely to have it versus the branded versions. But then, it could be something in like rice, and in particular, like in international, rice, like basmati rice, probably is more likely to have it, which is why they kind of tell you to
rinse
it.
Rinse
or at least my mom told me that, when you cook the rice, you rinse it. And
rinse
a lot
it
of
first.
It, yeah, it could be the starch and the talc and
put
other
in rice
things.
Too, so prevent the rice grains from sticking.
Yeah, not all, but it helps with the preventing the sticking.
There was a study that is cited in this recent review from Stanford that showed that some of the rice, I think it was in China, was tested and they found talc on the rice particles. So it's again an industrial lubricant. It prevents jamming in the machines in mass production of food.
Yeah.
And so talc is really kind of everywhere.
Like in makeup. I mean, it's probably in my foundation or something. And I mean, it's just everywhere.
And we've learned a lot about talc and the potential carcinogenic risk over the last 30 years or so. And it was It was not well appreciated just a few decades ago that it could be linked to potentially human cancer.
Well, that's what's nuts, is we thought it was just in baby powder. There was a big effort to get talc out of baby powder.
Yeah.
But we're eating it.
Yeah.
And so what I learned at this roundtable, were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say that I think initially people thought that talc was carcinogenic because it also had asbestos in it. But then even when you look at talc separate from the asbestos-containing talc, it still had a concerning safety signal. And you're going to say, and then there's still residual amounts we're ingesting.
And inhaling.
And inhaling and putting on our face.
So this
go ahead.
This all started in 1993 when the National Toxicology Program did a report and they found quote unquote clear evidence of carcinogenic activity in animal studies with talc. And then that spurred this series of studies that was reviewed. All the studies from 1990 to 2013 were reviewed and specifically looking at ovarian cancer, and they found that there was a statistically significant association between talc exposure and ovarian cancer with an odds ratio of 1.3. So roughly a 30% increase in ovarian cancer. And in some cases, when there was higher exposure, there was believed to be an even greater risk of ovarian cancer. Now, ovarian cancer, I think, affects 1 in 67 women. We now generally believe it comes, the most common forms come from the fallopian tube.
Yeah, not the ovary itself.
And so there was a pathologist at this expert panel who actually said, I was looking at ovarian cancer cells after resection and could see talc in the ovarian cancer
cells. The tissues.
In the tissue.
Wow.
Then in 2019, there was a review of 30 studies that found a similar 1.3 odds ratio in its causing cancer. So it sort of affirmed the other review. And then in Taiwan, they did a study where they found oral talc consumption was associated with stomach cancer. And guess what cancers in the United States are going up in young people? It's the GI cancers with no known cause. Now, I'm not suggesting, gotta be careful in this role. We're not saying, you know, this is driving our chronic disease epidemic or this is driving rates of cancer in young people to go up when rates of cancer in other groups are going down. We don't know. It's a scientific unknown. But we have enough studies now that are pointing to the health concerns of talc. And I remember as a surgical resident, we would put talc in the chest tube because it was known it would create this intense inflammatory reaction. And that would create such an inflammatory storm in the pleural cavity that it would create scar tissue. And it did it very effectively. That scar tissue would keep the lung suspended.
Yeah, we should explain this. So this is called pleurodesis. And so, unfortunately, there's a subset of people who have pleural effusions or fluid around the lung. Often it's cancer-related. They have cancer there. And that cancer sort of weeps fluid there. And that kind of causes the inflatable part of the lung to collapse and the fluid to fill around it. And you can have patients who have shortness of breath, and they have to keep coming into the doctor, and we keep tapping them and removing that fluid, pleurocentesis, and take it off. But after a while, that becomes so onerous. We say, is there something we can do to just keep the lung inflated? We used to put talcum powder in the cavity and get the lung to stick to the outside wall of the chest so that it stays inflated and the fluid has no place to go.
And when you say inflated, like it's basically to stay inflamed.
There's an inflammatory reaction on the edge, and then it creates fibrosis, and it actually becomes kind of stitched together, like micro-stitched, they're adherent. And this is called pleurodesis. And the surgeons were the ones who were doing it, surgeons like Marty. Wow.
Guilty as charged. I did it, and...
But that was the standard of care.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And
I mean, the reason is because they, at the time, did not recognize the health concerns with talc, or at the time even asbestos-contaminated talc, that we do today. And it was such a powerful driver of inflammation. And what strikes me as somebody who's taken care of inflammatory bowel disease, which has been going up with no known cause, we have no idea why. I mean, I have my hypotheses that we're altering the microbiome and ingesting so many pro-inflammatory agents in the modern diet. But here is something that causes inflammation. At the same time, we're seeing a rise in inflammatory bowel disease, inflammatory conditions, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, all these inflammatory conditions that drive chronic disease coupled with insulin resistance. That's kind of like the 1-2 punch. General body inflammation caused by that cumulative effect of all these chemicals that go down the GI tract, and insulin resistance probably explains a lot of disease that we are trained to treat, but not really told what may be an underlying root cause.
So, but one question for you, and are there alternatives? You mentioned that there are some other tablet, 2 and 4 and 7, they don't have it in them. So what are the alternatives to machine tablets that don't require talc?
That was pretty one of the amazing things I learned yesterday is, right, despite having all this evidence, there are alternatives that exist. And there's a couple of them, right,
yes,
that are naturally occurring that are already being used in production.
Magnesium stearate was mentioned in the expert panel. I think it was calcium stearate as well.
And
I asked the expert on the panel, everyone should go watch this panel. We're going to post it on all these social media platforms, starting at the beginning. Now with the elevator music first.
I know, that was a pet peeve.
I know, that was
a pet peeve. Yeah, it needs to start with the starting of
speech.
Start
with the welcome, yeah.
Yeah.
So people are going to see this incredible discussion where this expert who talked about these low-cost, these alternatives, I asked him what the cost was, and he said they're comparable, and they're low-cost alternatives.
And widely available, as far as availability.
Widely available.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me. We don't talk about that. How many oncology conferences have I gone to where We're talking about cancer in every dimension. We're talking about the sort of the soul of the person we treat with cancer. We're talking about the cost. We're talking about the latest discoveries. We're talking about chemo and radiation and proton beam and CAR T therapy and immunotherapy and sophisticated technical operations. We talk about every aspect of cancer care at our oncology meetings, except what might be causing cancer, yeah. Right? And to me, that is just mind-boggling.
Modifiable exposure over the course of a lifetime that can be mitigated is something that is woefully under-discussed in every oncology conference I've ever been
but
to.
But it makes sense, right? The system is working the way it was designed from an economic incentive point of view, right? Yeah. I mean, we incentivize physicians to treat. I'm not saying, you know, physicians don't care about the root causes, but in their day-to-day practice, you're thinking about what are the treatments.
You have
not
people coming in the door who have cancer already, and you have to take care of them, and that's what you're thinking about. And also, the science of root cause, it's tough. I mean, we're exposed to lots of things in the course of our lives, and we are all very different people, and trying to separate these things is a very difficult scientific task.
So I guess the question, so we had this roundtable discussion, right, to open our eyes to all of this evidence, a lot that's been around for a couple of decades now, and there's more evidence coming out. And there's a viable alternative, some of which is being used, some that's not so much. So, Marty, why is it that we think as an industry, just the implementation of a substitute would just be too hard to bear? Maybe that's why we haven't acted on this yet? Or, like, why have we been ignoring this?
The few people I've talked to on the manufacturing side are generally unaware of this body of literature that and expertise that it has been, you know, waving a flag, say, whoa, hey, you know, this may be a carcinogen, and it may be no coincidence that the orally ingested talc in the Taiwan study caused stomach cancer, and it may be no coincidence that the talc powder that was used in women in the study of ovarian cancer, the proximity and the finding of talc in ovarian tissue in patients with cancer. They're saying, look, this is no coincidence. You're right, Vinay. Sometimes the root causes are hard to study or impossible to study,
right?
The impact of red dye number 40 on cancer rates. We know sometimes these are causing inflammation. Sometimes we have animal studies, but in this case, actually, there's a ton of data that we've just not been talking about. It's just I don't want to say ignoring it because that implies some malice, and I don't think there is any malice. I think the scientific community has caught up with the studying this molecule, and we just have not been. We're disconnected from that community. I mean, the scientists that were in at the talc roundtable were impressive. I've never heard of them.
Yeah.
They don't come to our oncology meetings.
Yeah,
and it's like front and center. These are the root causes that get me excited because we can actually take a hard look at this with an evidence-based approach and use common sense. Because I don't think anyone would want to say, yeah, there's a lot of evidence to suggest it causes cancer. But you know what? Let's just wing it. The kids will probably be fine. Yeah, the rates of cancer are going up in kids. Yes, the rates of inflammatory conditions are going up in kids. But, it's probably not from that. You know, who thinks like that?
Yeah, I just want to make one point, which is that one of the things you've taken on is mitigating potentially harmful substances that Americans are ingesting, millions of Americans. That includes your petroleum-based dye initiative that's touching on this talc issue. And on other issues, we've talked about the importance of randomized control trials. So sometimes people say to me, oh, how come you don't need randomized control trials to take out the petroleum-based dyes? And I say that, this is just a simple teaching point. The evidence to take a medical product that's supposed to make you better is different than the evidence to mitigate a potentially harmful substance you're ingesting for which there are substitutes, for which there are no real clear benefits. So the standard to remove a petroleum-based dye that, if anything, just makes cereal more visually appealing to children and has no real purpose, that standard is going to be different than injecting yourself with a yearly booster. And so naturally for medical therapies, we ask for randomized data, but we don't ask it for risk factor mitigation. We don't ask it to tell people to stop smoking or to remove petroleum-based dyes or to take action on talc. And that's a fundamental difference between public health, which is one hat you wear, and being a doctor, which is another hat you wear, and you're doing both in the commissioner role. So I think it's good to explain that to people.
And Vinay, I mean, you make a good point. We talked about this last time around that meeting I had with a couple of the scientists talking about another different food chemical that I can't name just yet, and we were reviewing the literature.
Unpronounceable
and
names.
Right? I mean, I'm still learning all these names. But it's that different standard of what type of studies and correlation and causation, but with food, it is so hard to isolate every single one and then do this 20-year-long study. And
to me, it's intuitive that,
it's common sense.
It's common sense. Like, you know, I need to be, I don't want to ingest dyes that may potentially be harmful. I have a much lower threshold to try to eat healthy, you know, than I do to, like, get medical products.
And what was powerful, sorry, Marty, but what was powerful about the roundtable discussion was that you had experts from all different segments, right? You had NIH, you had, you know, Stanford and Brigham, you had someone from university out in Australia, you had industry, right? And everybody had a different lens on the evidence and focusing on different methods and types of data. And they all said, we're never going to have 100% kind of knowledge here, right? If it's like a puzzle, you're going to have a couple of pieces missing. But we have enough pieces to kind of see the puzzle, right? And that's enough to say that if there is an alternative, and there's enough compelling data, we should probably do something, right? And they were all consistent in that.
And then the other thing we think about at FDA is, what is the evidence for the alternative? Is the alternative safe? What do you know about the alternatives? And so that, you know, that's part of this discussion too and part of this thinking.
Yeah, when there's a low-cost alternative, that changes the whole calculus of why are we taking this risk, right? If we're taking the risk for a potential big benefit, that's one thing. But we're taking it when there's a low-cost alternative.
Don't you want colorful breakfast cereal, Marty?
Oh, you're talking about the petroleum-based food guys.
Yeah, but you know, all these issues.
It's
the same. And you've approved a bunch of food dyes that are from natural products. Right, yeah.
Yeah, food dyes from natural colors. We love them. Yeah. We love them. And so we've approved a bunch more. So with three just about a week and a half ago.
Yep.
But on the talc, and by the way, your point about the vaccines, it's interesting because our job, as we are commissioned by Congress, is to review evidence and then green light chemicals based on what is safe and effective. Generally, we're talking about drugs and devices, right? So in the vaccine world, in the vaccine booster world, we have new vaccine boosters that are creating a new protein in the body. If you think about that camp that we talked about last time, that is the blindly approved boosters every year in perpetuity with no clinical trials. I forget what you called it, BPP.
BBPP, double BP.
Yeah, without clinical trials, WCT, maybe. So that philosophy and that camp, which is alive and well and vocal inside. It's a minority group, but they're really telling us to suspend our responsibility to determine what's safe and effective and to green light new things based on, an assumption. Yeah. So I think the talc thing, sorry to go back to the COVID world.
I think it's interesting to draw the distinctions between the two kind of fundamental roles you have as FDA commissioner.
But it ties to what you've been saying all along about common sense and gold standard science, right? These are all different types of studies and methods and evidence, but you have to think about it a little bit nuanced and differently based off the application and the use case.
Evidence is always contingent on the specific question you face, and that question is different in these two use cases.
And it's, you know, it's something that comes up in your world of cancer drug approvals all the time. Do you look at surrogate endpoints, or do you look at clinical endpoints that are meaningful to patients, that is overall survival?
So this is another terrific point, which is that our regulatory framework acknowledges that the evidence to give a blind booster in perpetuity to a 7-year-old healthy girl, we're going to want to see evidence that makes us confident the benefits outweigh the risks. But if somebody has a life-threatening terminal disease, it's a rare condition, there are not that many people out there, that person should have tremendous regulatory flexibility to choose to take products based on surrogate or intermediary markers while we continue to follow up survival and real-world data sets. So it's not one size fits all across all of these questions.
100%. Yeah. And not even rare conditions.
Yeah, common.
Common cancers. Surrogate endpoints are powerful. Yeah. But we should also be looking at these overall survival endpoints after the approval. And we'll be able to do that with our big data team, which is actually right next door working like crazy. And so they're going to help consolidate the adverse event databases. They're working on this big post-approval monitoring data set that's going to be powerful.
So back to kind of talc and food then, right? You're not going to have survival endpoints in that context necessarily, right? It's a little bit of a different mechanism. So where do we go from here? We have this great discussion, great evidence presented. What happens now?
So to me, for 30 years, we've known talc causes cancer in animal studies. And then we have all of these other studies in humans. We have enough suspicion. You can see where I'm going with this, but I'm not going to make any announcements right now. But this is a conversation with the petroleum-based food dyes. We looked at the heavy hand of regulation, the hammer. And we looked at the civil courtesy of working with industry to get them to voluntarily remove these products. So we're going to have an internal set of meetings to talk about talc. But it's amazing to me to think that 20 million plus Americans are taking this daily in their medications, assuming they're compliant. And on top of that, kids are eating it in candy all the time. And yet we had this big pile on to make sure we get out of the business, that people stop exposing women to talc on powder on their surface. So, and to me, there's something potentially big here. It's a little tragic. It's taken over 30 years for us to have an FDA panel where we bring in experts to talk about this, but it was good. I encourage everybody to go and watch it. I got a ton out of it.
It was really eye-opening.
We're going to post it. So I think it's one of those great opportunities we have at the FDA to look at not just medications and therapeutics, but also root causes because of the jurisdiction we have over food.
And that's just the first of many that you have planned, right? You're planning to convene a couple of other expert panels on a few other topics.
Hormone replacement therapy and menopause. Menopause has just not gotten the attention it deserves. And unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation on menopause. I mean, I remember a woman came into clinic once with all of these symptoms, all this whole constellation of symptoms. And, you know, everyone went to the back room where we, you know, code and bill and chart and document. I call it the coding room. It's called the clinical room, but we spend all our time there. You know, what code for this? So we went back there, and everyone came up with these elaborate theories of what could connect all these symptoms. And then it was like a female medical student that said, "Hey guys," it was because it's mostly men, she's going through menopause. And it just hit me like we still are not properly teaching menopause. There was a general feeling that a hormone replacement therapy, which can not only alleviate the symptoms, but if started before age 60, can have incredible long-term health benefits to bone, heart, all kinds of things. And because of the dogma that it causes breast cancer, I should say that it increases the risk of dying of breast cancer, which has never been found to be true. The increased risk of breast cancer mortality, never been proven. Because of that dogma, people have felt like, well, there's nothing you can treat menopause with. So why educate students on menopause or residents on menopause? There's nothing you can do for it. So just women just kind of need to tough it out unless they want to take some cancer risk. That was generally the dogma. And so we're going to be bringing in experts to address the latest state-of-the-art science on that topic and some others.
Yeah, I'm excited. Yeah. It'll be fun to unpack it.
Exciting times here.
Great. Well, I can tell Vinay is dying to get back to his office because he has a giant stack of meetings.
That's true. Very true.
Hesitate to say that because what's to say about me? Like maybe, you know.
You've got a lot to do. You're probably late for a meeting.
We
right
got
now.
A full bunch of meetings today, and it's been great. We got just some exciting. I wish I could sort of share every meeting I have this afternoon with the world because this is a great opportunity. It's a great time. It's a great FDA, so great to see you, Vinay. Great to see you, Angela.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, we'll see you again soon.